This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with us. And you know, I've decided not to invite anybody today because...
Because we're starting fresh.
Yes. No, not really starting fresh. I just thought for all time's sake.
No, it is.
Just the two of us on men's health for a change.
Right.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has been a long time. In fact, you know, we had a really good run of courtesy of AIA Vitality, mm-hmm. Did Doctor in the House. Thank you very much for the sponsorship.
Yep.
And then, so obviously that has come to the end, and then we're beginning our new season.
Non-sponsored Doctor in the House.
That's correct. Okay. I'm sure we can attract some sponsorship later on.
If you're interested, that's yes, why not?
Exactly. And then, mm-hmm. obviously, you know, this is a good opportunity, platform for us to start new things. And especially, we're doing something quite different from the last time, right? Apart from now we're having the show without the guests, we're also doing some streaming, right?
Yes, we are. So we're on Facebook Live right now. If you would like to log on, please go ahead and do that. If you have a question, you can pose it on Facebook Live, and you know, our producer Tina is right here. She'll actually pose those questions and we can answer them on air. So today's show is going back to the very basics of what, you know, is very close to George's heart, which is men's health issues. And the only reason we decided to do both of that is because there were two leading stories in the last week or so.
Indeed.
Which was the super gonorrhea, which has been treated, which is a huge breakthrough as far as, because we worry about gonorrhea and the fact that it's becoming resistant to antibiotics.
What a relief.
Absolutely. And another one was a penis and scrotum transplant for a soldier in the US, former soldier in the US, which, you know, looks very promising in terms of transplantation and what they've achieved mm-hmm. from that. So if you have a question, any other question related to men's health, we have picked up some of the questions from our health event also, which are men's health related, which we will answer after we've gone through these two articles.
Yeah.
So give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Right. So let's kick off, George. I mean, what did you think of the super gonorrhea?
you would have to pick that one first.
Story. Of course I have to do that. You know, and what they found is a man in the UK who caught this world's worst ever case of super gonorrhea yeah. has been cured. I mean, how does anybody decide on what is the world's worst ever super gonorrhea, George?
Well,
I mean, what does that mean?
Well, I guess, you know, it is the sensationalizations by the press, really.
Really?
Yeah, in a way, how do you work out whether this is the world's super, multi-resistant gonorrhea? Effectively, this is a man who had been tried on different medications of antibiotics and then subsequently, eventually, one antibiotic called etoprenem seems to solve the problem. I think this is a good story. It's a good story in many aspects because it's actually related to our part of the world.
If
you read it a little bit closer, this British man, despite having a British partner, and then they just keep saying, about he contracted this in Southeast Asia, you know, having sexual activities with, people he shouldn't have been having sex with, and then hence contracted it. Make it sound really awfully dirty place this is.
I know.
Yeah, terrible, terrible. And then subsequently, another two cases of similar nature came up in Australia. Mm-hmm. And then another
one. But they had not traveled to Southeast Asia.
Well, one of them had traveled to Southeast Asia. The other had one. So, you know, the media keeps going on about this Southeast Asia thing, which I want to take issue with.
Okay.
Yeah. So number one.
Point noted.
Point noted. All right, BBC, get it out of your system. Right? You know, it's not just Southeast Asia that we have that problem. I think it's reported in the UK is because they have got good statistics that, record all these multi-resistance. And in Malaysia, I'm reasonably certain that we encounter patients in that situation. I have encountered mm-hmm. patients in that situation. That
have you come across anybody who has not been able to treat it, who has not been able to be treated because of antibiotic resistance?
Indeed, yeah. I have.
So what do you do then?
So you carry on trying multiple lines of antibiotics until you actually get rid of it.
Right. Okay.
So, well, the problems about gonorrhea, it comes in several folds. Number one, obviously, you know, men who has been naughty with extracurricular activities, they probably get it, you know, from an extramarital affairs and then infected their partners.
So they're the higher risk group.
Correct.
In a way.
After you have cleared their infection, they get it back from their partner. Right. Who are oblivious of their infection. So that is one kind of like a scenario that keeps putting men at risk of multiple episodes of infections. Mm-hmm. That itself is a difficult situation to treat. You treat one condition and then it actually disappeared and then it get reinfected. That's number one issues. Number two issue, perhaps you have to start thinking about men who think their symptom disappeared perhaps don't finish the course of antibiotics right. that are prescribed, because when they come in to see me, they have a lot of pain, they have discomfort when they urinate, and they have this discharge that is copious. I know it is a Friday afternoon, you ought not talk about discharge. You should see Mira's face on Facebook Live. You know, she is just rolling her eyes and go, man, you know, you should be punished for whatever activities.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay, but,
not
but
at all.
It is a bit disgusting, but as soon as the antibiotics goes in, the symptoms disappears quite quickly. However, if you don't finish the course of antibiotics, then it's problematic because the unresolved issue may reemerge.
How long do you have to be on antibiotics?
Normally, it's 5 to 7 days. Some people even up to 10 days. But majority of men, after the 3rd days, they kind of forget about the whole thing and then they will probably not finish it. The fourth issue is that they don't always go back to get retested. Right. So in order to make sure that you're 100% eradicated for such pathogens, you need to go back and get retested.
Okay.
The problem about they going back to not getting back to retested is because of, number one, this is not like normal urinary tract infection where you pee into a bottle, you hand it to the nurse and the nurse will just send to the lab and culture it over a few days. Because gonorrhea is a type of bacteria that is obligate in the cell. It's called intracellular obligate pathogens. That means that they only survive within the cells. We can't culture them. So the way to determine whether someone has got bacteria or not, the old styles is that we use a brush, put it into the middle of the penis, swab it, and then look under a microscope and see whether we see any sign of gonorrhea. But new way of doing it is using the DNA. We detect the DNA in the swabs. So that is expensive because it's a really accurate technology and many men would not spend that sort of money in order to determine whether they are eradicated of the infections or not.
Okay. And gonorrhea, let me just reconfirm, can only transmit through sexual
intercourse. Contact, yeah, okay. In the past, we always make the assumption that it is either vaginal intercourse or anal intercourse that actually can resume, that can result in such infection. However, the latest WHO figures and the latest data from various health authority shows that oral sex carries significant risk of transmission of such pathogens as well.
Oh dear.
So, naughty boys and naughty girls out there.
You don't that's have a problem. To be naughty, George.
Well, it just needs to be eradicated.
Not, yeah, I know.
It's the multiple partner and unprotected intercourse that actually results in this. So, the message is obviously, you know, stay faithful, man, BFM, right? Yeah. Okay.
How do you test for women for gonorrhea?
Well, it's the same strategy, using a swab in order to detect the get secretions from the vagina, and then we will test for the DNA using a strategy called PCR DNA test.
Okay. What about syphilis, George? They say there's a rising incidence of syphilis as well.
I know.
What is syphilis? Can you explain to
me? Okay, syphilis is caused by, it used to be called VD, right? A venereal disease. And essentially, we thought it's all, you know, these are all the disease of the past that actually diminish with smallpox and various, Jurassic age pathogens, but they're re-emerging just like multi-drug resistance TBs. So syphilis actually it's a lot more dangerous kind of bacteria. Yeah, okay. From sexual contact, it can have primary, secondary, tertiary, even quaternary syphilis. Many people believe that someone like Henry VIII in those days actually contracted syphilis through the transmissions of their syphilis into the brain, so cause it to be a little bit dullarly. It's a little bit hallucinatory because it can spread to different parts of the brain and it can destroy nerves and cause almost like a multiple sclerosis kind of destruction of different parts of the brain. Some people may even have destructions of nerves to the extent that they have neurological defects. So syphilis is dangerous. But the story about syphilis is a bit similar to gonorrhea in the sense that the antibiotics penicillin was discovered almost 100 years ago. An initial most important pathogens to be treated were syphilis and also gonorrhea. Syphilis, the vast majority of the bacteria is still responsive to penicillin. So men or women presented with syphilis are still being treated with injection of penicillin. But gonorrhea has evolved so much of multi-drug resistant. Initially, penicillin was sensitive, and then quinolones group was sensitive. Now only ceftriaxones or doxycycline or metronidazole is sensitive. But this man in Britain is not sensitive to any of these anymore, and therefore we went into a newer and newer generations of the drugs. So the key story that BBC wanted to run was that the president of Sexual Health Infection Disease Society highlighted that this is a wake-up call.
Yes.
We have this multi-drug resistant due to several reasons. Number one, I highlighted that if we have a sufferer who doesn't finish the course of antibiotics, this is contributing to the problems. Number two, what they wanted to highlight in Southeast Asia is not just the condition is prevalent, it is also because the drugs are easily accessible over the counter.
Yes. So in countries where antibiotics are accessible over the counters, then resistance is a lot higher.
Correct, for several reasons. Because you may not have the disease and you've already taken the antibiotics. You don't have the right instructions, then you'll take the antibiotics inappropriately. And lastly, disposables of these antibiotics, you know, because for those men who buy them prophylactically just before they engage in any sexual activities, or they just buy them as spares, and then when they don't finish the antibiotics, sometimes they throw them away.
Can it work as a prophylactic?
Not at all, because we actually don't have any data to prove that if you take it beforehand, you actually have less risk of infection. But men who actually experience multiple infections might think that is a good strategy. Mm. But you're putting yourself at risk, because whenever you take these antibiotics in the appropriate dosage, during exposure, when the dosage at the point of contact is decreasing, then this bacteria is clever enough to build up resistance, and then you might become the record of the world's most infected man. I mean, just imagine you hold that title of the world's most dangerous or most infectious gonorrhea man.
Isn't that what this guy is?
Indeed.
What they're referring to him
That's
as.
That's right.
Who the world's worst ever case of super gonorrhea. Why super gonorrhea? I mean, has this bacteria evolved over time?
The super part.
You can't use the word mutation for bacteria, can you? Viruses, yes?
It can be mutation, because they can actually import the multi-drug resistant genes in order to become mutated that way,
right.
Or they can change forms in order to build up ways to reject the antibiotics, and that's how their mutation works. So I guess if you label it as superbug, right, which MRSA in the UK is called, which is like methicillin, multi-drug resistant staph aureus.
The hospital
bacteria. If you call it the superbug, then people will take a lot more actions, or, you know, pay more attention to it, because it is a superbug.
Right. So are you concerned about gonorrhea?
Myself?
No.
No,
yourself, of course.
Mm. No, of course not, right? Yeah. Okay, because I'm very careful and clean, and you know I'm a loyal kind of guy, right? Okay, I'm faithful.
I never doubted that.
Okay. Anyway, the problem about gonorrhea, or obviously in my line of patients, is that majority of men who are treated, they don't return to have themselves confirmed that they have eradicated of that condition. That kind of concerns me a little bit. And number two is the compliance of the medications. Mm-hmm. I really think many of the guys who come and see me, and ladies, and then who really don't get this eradicated. And number three is contact tracing. It's always really difficult for them to kind of like built up a courage to go to the sexual partner and say, look, I got infected. Can you just get yourself treated? And that sort of culture is still a big taboo. In the UK, we have genital urinary infection medicine as a specialty. And then they will do a lot of counselling and help them to contact trace in order to eradicate this in more larger scale. But however, in the Malaysian setting, sexual health and sexual infection is a huge taboo. And then therefore, it is difficult to contact trace and treat both partners because it takes two to tangle.
Absolutely. And when you talk about syphilis and chlamydia, are they becoming resistant as well?
Syphilis, it's probably not as prevalent as gonorrhea. Chlamydia is increasingly becoming an issue. The problem about chlamydia, even in men, they don't have such symptoms of copious discharge. You just get a little bit burning sensation, colourless discharge around the underpants. And then so they most of the time assume that it's nothing serious. So with that basis, many men may actually harbour the bacteria without knowing about it.
Right.
So probably not as much issues with drug resistant, but gonorrhea potentially can be that beginning of the apocalypse that we were talking about. Mm. We had multiple shows talking about one day a simple infection on the skin can no longer be treated with antibiotics. And then, you know, an infection such as simple pneumonia probably will need to be restricted by that antibiotics given to patients. And that is a grim view of what the world will become. And then that will cost many, many lives because penicillin saved millions and millions of lives in the last 100 years. For the next 100 years, if this British man who is a super gonorrhea sufferer and then who really did not have a drug that eliminated this, we are at the brink of that apocalypse.
Okay, so stay safe is the message.
And stay faithful.
And finish your course. Finish your course of antibiotics. I'm not going to lecture anybody, George. I think we're old enough.
It's Friday.
We're old enough to know what we're doing, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to come back and now talk about the penis and scrotum transplant, which was carried out very successfully at the Johns Hopkins University in Maryland. And we'll be answering some of your questions, which you brought up at the BFM Health and Living event in regards to men's health. Or you can call us right now. You don't have to give us your name. Get it out of your system. I know some of you want to do HIV tests, but you don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
For an example, what about your confidentiality? Mm-hmm. If you were to, for an example, go and get yourself tested, what does the test entail? Even for sexually transmitted infections, how do those tests, how are they carried out? What about confidentiality issues?
And so, also have a look at us on Facebook Live, and then you'll realize that we are really not that vicious, and then we're quite friendly people who'd answer your questions.
I am not vicious at all. Nobody thinks I'm vicious, George. Okay, so we are on Facebook Live. If you want to send us a question through there, you can do that. Or you can give us a call right now. The number is 0377 109000. Tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0187898899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Doctor in the House series. I am Meera Sivasodhi. In the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and we are discussing men's health issues. If you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 0377 109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0187898899. We're on Facebook Live. If you want to pose a question there, that's fine. Tina's in the studio, ready to take those questions, or if you just want to watch George
having a black eye.
Yes. Anyway, okay, we have a we're going to move on to the next story, George. It's about the first surgery on a combat veteran who was injured on duty.
Yes.
And the first to transplant a complete section of tissue, including the scrotum and surrounding abdominal area. Now, the first penis transplant in the US was done in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2014, South African surgeons performed the world's first successful penis transplant. transplant. So everybody's saying they're the first.
That's right.
I'm not terribly sure.
In fact,
was
the Chinese, oh my goodness, actually said that they did it 5 years prior to that.
Them too.
Mm-hmm. And then they said that apparently this guy was so traumatized after waking up, regretted it so badly that the surgeon had to remove it again. And then they say, okay, the graft was intact in that man for 24 hours or so. So they technically were the first. What is this obsession about the first person who transplanted the penis, right?
You tell me, like, you're male. I don't really care, honestly.
That's right. So is this important?
I think it is.
It is important because it plays several roles. Because, and although, you know, of course, there is a sad side of things. This is a soldier who went to Afghanistan, stepped on a landmine, accidentally blasted this groin area, and then obviously traumatized that area. And in fact, these sort of cases is copious in country like US, where they sent a lot of their young men to the war field.
Yeah.
And then so when they're in the front line, when they come back with a situation like this, they even have a conference in order to deal with issues of sexual intimacy after a trauma induced by war. So that can reflect what a big scale and what sort of negative impact the war has on young men and their families and their sexual life.
Mm-hmm.
And for somebody who have complete destruction in their groin, this is something that obviously is a breakthrough, right? So jokes aside, this is a serious condition that can be looked into. I mean, the previous articles about who's the first, one in the States, one in South Africa, one in China, they're all severed penises that were joined together, you know, by microsurgery in order to put a transplanted penis into an amputated penis. Either is because of traumatic severed or cancer.
Hmm.
And of course, those are quite rare. But in order to do something like this, we technically are using a en bloc method of transplanting a deceased cadaver's bodily part, one whole section of it. It's called vascularized composite allotransplantation. Vascularized is because it's en bloc together, it's blood supply to the bones, the tendons, the ligaments, the penis, the scrotum, all together without the testicle. And then the whole en bloc is just put onto another person. That's why it's allotransplantation, because it's from one human to another human of a different genetic makeup. And it's composite because it's in en bloc. So imagine if someone can do that. Of course, we are dealing with a group of soldiers who had been injured in that area. But that might potentially be the beginning of a lot of other ways. That means that we can transplant different parts of the organ, no matter how complicated. We can do composite transplantation of the chest, the back, the legs and everything. So then we're venturing into a situation where that can potentially be a solution for sex change.
Yep.
That can be a solution for somebody who perhaps would like to have a larger external genitalia.
So is this different because, and it's made news because they've transplanted everything, the skin, the bones, the muscles, and they've not done that in the past?
Correct.
Are you saying that it's a functioning penis and scrotum?
Correct. So if
Which
you imagine... Well,
in the past it was just aesthetic.
In the Chinese one, we cannot do anything. We cannot really assess a long-term benefit of such transplantation.
Mm-hmm.
It was a penis that was put into of a deceased, a donor that was put into a man, and eventually that was removed. The South Africa's one actually was believed to even be able to function sexually normally, urinating normally, and even father a child.
Right.
So it's not for aesthetic purposes. And then, you know, for a man who, let's say, suffers from penile cancer, this will be a complete breakthrough that will restore their sexual life. But all those are an organ that is put together. But this is an en bloc of all the ligaments or the bones or the tendons of a front part of your body being compositely allograft.
What I found quite interesting, George, is they said that, you know, they transplanted the penis and the scrotum, but the testicles were not transplanted due to ethical considerations. Why?
There are several reasons why that is the case. Number one is that the blood supply of the testicle actually comes from the abdomen. So even if we wanted to transplant the testicle together, the blood supply of the testicle actually is separate from the rest of the body. Mm-hmm. Okay. Number two is that testicular organs are extremely sensitive to blood supply deprivation. So let's say from a deceased person, to transplant the testicles together, you might actually have a testicle that is completely non-functioning, mm-hmm. because the sperm's production will not survive. But whenever you actually take the ethics into this, transplantation of the body part actually just means that you and another person's body part is in your body, but it still belongs to that person. But when you take the testicle, which has the gametes of the deceased, and actually subsequently impregnate an egg, so technically you will have the deceased genetic material that will be brought to the next generation.
Right, okay.
So how much
of that... So it will not help you make your own sperm?
Correct. Because this genetic material technically is from the other person, and that sperm will not make into the recipient. The recipient suddenly cannot make their own sperms because the genetic materials are all the donor's genetic material in the gametes in the sperms.
Okay.
So, I mean, this raises a lot of issues, right? First of all, should this be done? Is this a medical marvel that push forward the frontier of science? And how much can we push forward? Like, you know, now we can do this. Does that mean that someone who wants to have sex change can be... This is doable, but is it permissible? Is ethically correct or incorrect? And then lastly, if we are able to transplant the testicles, will that mean that you know, the ethical barriers is all broken down? So I think that raised a lot of issues, and that is a convenient time to invite a conversation in Klang Valley into this issue.
Genital transplant surgery is not life-saving.
That's exactly what this is all about. See, the...
So then is it worth it? Is it worth going through all of this, you know, the long-term consequences? I mean, they need to take immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of their lives, am I correct?
Yes. So this is what we're talking about. I'm glad you raised that issue, because this is when we're going to invite a lot of conversation. Because what constitutes... The liberalists will say, look, this is pushing forward the frontier of science, and whether this is a life-saving or not life-saving is dependent on that patient,
mm-hmm.
because the society should not impose any judgment onto that.
Yeah.
The conservative will say, how far can we push this? This is a non-life-saving intervention. It costs a lot of money. It used 11 surgeons in order to make this possible.
But it will help him regain urinary function? Correct?
We're not transplanting the bladder. His urinary function perhaps was not an issue to start off with. But the en bloc transplant of the penis will give him a conduit to function, to pee like a man, to stand up to pee like a man.
Right. And it will help him with sexual function?
Well, according to this report, it is already helping him to gain erection, ejaculation, and so on and so forth. So
he will lead more of a normal life than he did before.
Correct. Because prior to that, he will have no external genitalia at all. So the big questions that I ask you, I want to invite you into this conversation.
Why?
Because I always put you on the spot.
I am here.
Yeah, indeed. So you're on the spot. I'm going to ask you, this is not life-saving, but yet it is pushing forward the frontier of science. Should we or should we not?
I think we should, for cases like these. somebody who's gone to war and who has come back, and to help him lead. I mean, psychologically, this individual has already gone through so much at war.
Okay.
And then now to come back.
Okay.
And have to live, you know, without certain parts of his, you know.
Function, you know.
Yes, exactly.
External genitalia.
And even when he does this transplant, he's going to be psychologically affected by it.
Indeed.
So there's so much happening in this one person's brain. I think we should do everything we can to allow him to lead as normal a life as possible.
Even with the lifetime immunosuppressions?
Yes.
Okay, as long as he consents to it.
Yes.
Okay.
And if it's not abused for other reasons.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, so my question to you is, how do we decide to draw the line? Because who decides whether this case is severe enough and who decides it's not, whether this is war veteran or not war veteran? And who decides whether when we cross the line for anything mm-hmm. apart from traumatic induction as a result of war is permissible or not? And that's always the big question.
You know, I look at it this way as well. How many donors do you think there would be?
Well, the thing about donor is that majority of donors will probably just say, take what you think is necessary. Mm. You know, sometimes
it can be. And
that's
hardly the case that they would take the penis or
right,
the scrotum.
Exactly, which... Yeah. Currently, it's not a requirement because it's hardly ever being done. Mm-hmm. So majority of people will probably be assuming that they're consenting to the heart, to the lungs, to the liver,
yep.
to the kidneys, sometimes to the pancreas. And then the vast majority of people will think that it will be confined to visceral organs.
So my question to you, I mean, just before we let off from this conversation, I mean, it's enlightening indeed. But would you donate your penis or scrotum, George?
Now you're putting me on the spot.
What would happen in the afterlife if you went there without it?
Remember, I will live 235
yes,
years
I
from today. So I have quite a long time to consider.
And your traditional
that,
beliefs will tell me that you probably won't. Because you would want to go there complete.
Oh, you think so? Okay, well, you never know. You might be granted a bigger one.
Especially...
So you save your karma and then you might actually be all right.
All right. So we're going to come back now and answer some of your questions that you have posed to us during the BFM Health event. In fact, there's been some questions via telephone. And if you ever want to call us, the number is 0377109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Remember now, you can ask Dr. George any questions you want in regards to men's health or in his field of urology. For women, it includes urinary tract infections.
Incontinence. Kidney stones.
Absolutely. So, you know, ask us those questions and, you know, he's right here, all just free and, you know,
yeah,
ready to answer your questions.
Ready to answer. Apart from a very ugly black eye, I'm all right.
Yes, he's fine. So give us a call, 0377109000. Welcome back to the show. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. We are back in the last segment of the show before we exit before the 5 o'clock news. But now we're going to be addressing some of the men's health questions that have come through, during the event. And even now, if you have Dr. George Lee in the house answering your questions. So if you want to call us, give us a call. The number is 0377109000. Dave is asking, in the BBC, it was reported a new treatment for prostate. It's called prostate artery embolization. Mm-hmm. Is it available in Malaysia? Now, what is it, first of all, George?
Right. Embolization essentially just means we use either foreign body or something that is retrieved from the patient's body, like a clot.
Is this for an enlarged prostate or prostate cancer?
It can be done for both. So essentially, what you're trying to do is to starve the prostate of blood supply. Okay, so enlarged prostate sometimes is so huge that we actually just block off the blood supply in order to see whether we can shrink it. And then for cancer, for somebody who doesn't want conventional treatment like radiation or like operations, they may opt for something like that. Okay, first of all, it is not a very conventional treatment for prostate cancer or for enlarged prostate. And then number two is that it is available. It is available in many centres such as GH or UH in Malaysia.
Okay.
Because embolization itself can be done quite easily with a small intervention into the vessel, find the vessel that supplies the prostate and just block it off. You can block it off with titanium, you can block it off with clots, and you can block it off with all sorts of foreign materials in order to starve it. However, what I would like to say is, although BBC is seeing a little bit of optimism in the treatment for both enlarged prostate and cancer, what we are looking at is long-term benefits for this. It may not have that track records like cancer treated with radiation and surgery. And also, something like this can be quite painful. Imagine you starve one of your organs of blood supply. You might endure other forms of problems, such as pain. And that's always been the case for all these ablative intervention that is done on prostate or kidneys, is that you might end up with painful prostate. So although it might be available, however, I would like David to think about this very carefully prior to intervening.
Okay, because Dave says the UK says it's really promising.
So. It is promising. That's okay. The word they use. It's promising, right? Okay, promising and effective is a two different thing. One is at early stage, the other one has been tried and tested.
Okay, so we have a question here from someone who's saying, I have a question, but I'm a little bit shy to ask, but is there a cure for premature ejaculation?
Okay, right, okay. Premature ejaculation happens in one in three men out there, you know, in KL. We have done quite a few studies. So it's quite common. And they're due to two problems. Number one, there is a neurotransmitter in the brain that is a bit deficient. So perhaps men are born with such deficiency in neurotransmitter called 5-HT, and then therefore they have a tendency to ejaculate a bit faster. And then they also can be psychological, obviously anxiety and everything that relate to psychological self-confidence and sexual confidence may result in premature ejaculation. So counselling is good. Sexual therapy has been proposed. However, the good news is that there is a medication called duloxetine that is available in the market. It's been around for at least 7 years. I think see your doctor. You might actually get satisfactory treatment from that.
Okay. Next question. I'm 50. I have high cholesterol and I have an erection problem.
Okay.
Is it normal at this age and what's the remedy?
Okay, right. 50, it is a bit too early to get erectile dysfunction. However, your high cholesterol and perhaps a bit of truncal obesity and perhaps a lack of exercise, perhaps a smoking, high blood pressure, and also a bit of touch of diabetes, all that perhaps you have conveniently omitted to mention, all those are contributing towards the depletions of the blood supply to the penis. So if you only have high cholesterol, I think there's still plenty of hope. So exercise a lot, get rid of, cut down on those nasi lemak and roti canai, and then perhaps that will be an encouragement for you to restore your sexual function, because you only need all that to get the engine going. However, if you truly find it difficult or the blood vessel has become hardened, unfortunately, you have to start thinking about using medications. And the group of medication, like the blue pills, is called PDE5 inhibitors. I think for a 50-year-old man, I think that will benefit you a lot to restore that.
But you can try getting healthy first, perhaps.
Absolutely. Exercise, eat healthily.
And see if things work.
Absolutely.
Next question. What do you think of the recent increase of people facing fertility issues?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I have some opinion about that. I think because in our forefathers and, our parents' time, they started family a lot earlier. So, of course, your fertility is at its peak in your 20s. But we are really beginning to start family in our 30s. And then, therefore, your sperm counts and also your egg qualities, by definitions, will deplete a little bit. So infertility is more prevalent in their 30s. And besides, we are probably not as healthy as our parents, our forefathers, is because, with the food that we eat is very different. The food that we eat has been treated very differently. For example, the chickens and the poultry actually has been treated with hormones, antibiotics, vegetable has got pesticides, and we eat a lot more with wrappings of the, polystyrenes or, plastics.
Mm-hmm.
And all these are killing those little germs in your scrotum, man. So therefore, I think infertility issues for both men and women are all these both environmental and age factors that is destroying the fertility.
Okay, so hormones, your environment.
Correct.
And a lot of us don't realise, isn't it, the plastics come back to us.
Indeed. It's karma, right? Everything will come back to us.
It is, but we don't. When we don't see it, we don't realize how it's affecting us.
So, whatever you need to do, start a family earlier. You know, in your 20s, again, you know, then fertility issues will no longer be a big threat.
Yes, and you know, I just want to say something. If you ask somebody where, if you ask them where their water comes from, and if they say the tap, then you know they have no idea where the plastics go and how it's coming back to them.
Exactly. You just have to go to Redang or Perhentian and realize that 10 years ago and now the place is just filled with plastics.
Absolutely. And the last question. I've heard on average women live 7 years longer than men due to the fact that they're more concerned with their health, more so than men do, especially because they have their period every month and having children. I don't know where this rationale came from.
All that bleeding that you deplete yourself of, that vital essence.
You forgot about, you know, and is it true that generally women live 7 years longer than men?
It is true. Okay. Across all countries, from Swaziland to Japan, you know, which has got the highest life expectancy in the world, there will be a discrepancy between 5 to 7 years. This disparity has been puzzling scientists all along, right? You know, we don't really know whether it's conspiracy or not. Okay. No, it can't be conspiracy.
It is not conspiracy.
I think there are two reasons why, okay? It's one is genetic, the other one is environment, okay? The genetics, it's perhaps the, there are some studies done in Sweden to show that the XY chromosome in men actually are more, put men more at risk of heart disease and cancer. So I think that is a very exciting area because all along the time, we think that men are the stronger gender when it comes to physique and physical health. But now there's data to show that the XY gene might be actually put us at kind of like a vulnerable state if we don't look after our health. So at later stage of life, I think that's genetic part. The non-genetic part, I think men, the treatment-seeking behavior is a lot less to be desired. Yeah. Because and when a woman faces health problems, they tend to face it head on and then try to resolve the problem immediately. And men seem to have this attitude of, die-die-la. Or they will say it'll get better. You know, you see a lump in the testicle, you say, oh, I think it's getting smaller.
It's even just though it's and then ego.
Ego, okay,
yes.
Right. I try
long
to refrain.
Story short.
Yes, boil down to three letters.
Exactly.
EGO.
Absolutely.
It is true. So, guys out there, you know, it is true that it's costing our life expectancy by 7 years. So, put that ego aside. Go and see a doctor if you have any worries.
Okay. So that sort of concludes our show today. Next week, George, we're going to be talking about hepatitis C.
It's an exciting area to talk about.
It is indeed. I mean, Malaysia has now, you know, used something called a compulsory license on a legal basis to offer treatment for hepatitis C to Malaysians in government hospitals for free.
Yes.
And that's a huge development. We have been a trailblazer in the world in making that bold decision.
And we're proud of this.
Very proud of it. And so we're going to have that discussion next week.
Indeed.
So join us next Friday.
And then you can join us. You can send in some questions now if you wish.
If you want.
And then if you want to see what Mira is wearing next week, you can always look at our Facebook Live as well,
what
right?
What I'm wearing.
And then, And then also whether my black eye is getting better.
Okay. All right. Meanwhile, guess what?
What?
Tomorrow is nomination day.
All
so
right.
With GE14 coming our way, we'll sort of get a clearer picture of who's running tomorrow. And it's Sharad and Sharad Kutan and Melissa Idris of The Morning Show are going to do a special 2-hour edition of something called I Love KL because they're going to look at who the nominees are and what that means for you when you go out and vote.
Mm-hmm.
So that kicks off at noon. So make sure you're with us tomorrow, the nomination day coverage at 12 o'clock. Analysis will be given. There will be breaking news updates. So join us tomorrow at noon, 28th of April.
Okay.
It's getting exciting.
It is getting exciting. Battle for Malaysia,
yes,
right?
Battle for Malaysia.
Unfortunately, you know, for that coverage, it's only Klang Valley, right? I Love KL.
Yes.
But I'll be heading back to Kota Bharu to vote, guys.
So get our app. No, that's only nomination day tomorrow.
Well, I know, but the thing is that, you know, get yourself ready, you know, go back and get out there to vote because that's what we want, right? What we want, everyone to go out in force and actually do your duties to be a good citizen and vote.
Fantastic. So thank you for joining us, George. That was Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, speaking to us about, penis and scrotum transplantation, the super gonorrhea, and of course, all your questions. Join us every Friday at 4 o'clock on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.